Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I guess, Rabbit, this is the first program of this month, February.
Is it the first? No, it's actually not. Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, that's right, because we're at the 7th of February already. Pretty amazing.
Yes.
The year is just flying by, and pretty soon the snow will stop flying, and that will be all right, too.
And it's a good time, then, to talk about...
Soup.
Soup.
And not only soup, but the world's best soup, and a real soup expert to talk to us about that.
Our guest coming on right now, listeners, is Clifford A. Wright. And I think that that's a very important distinction, because if you go on Clifford Wright website, you'll find it's a different person. I was really relieved, Clifford, to know that that was not you, sponsored by Metamucil.
and Cheerios and Special
Cheerios
K.
And Special K.
That's right. So make sure it's Clifford A. Wright.
Exactly.
And this is a book that has its roots going back into Clifford's childhood.
Tell us about that.
Because he first remembers soup, and we can come back to that one in a second. The other thing that's very interesting is that it turns out that soup is almost as old as beer, and was first developed in the land between the rivers in Mesopotamia, in what is now, unfortunately, rather more of a combat zone. And so soup has a long history, and Clifford decided to enshrine it all in this wonderful book, which if it doesn't have every soup recipe ever known, it must be pretty close.
Yeah,
certainly has, I would say, the best soups in the world. Of course, that gives the title to the book as well. But it's interesting how the first recipes ever recorded, which go back some 5,000 years, in fact, were soups, because soups are about the easiest food to make. If you have a pot, you have a soup, and soups are based on water that is flavored, essentially. So that was kind of an interesting beginning. But you asked, Anne, about my childhood remembrances of soup, and that really was somewhat of an impetus for this book, because I had always hated, as a child, vegetable soup, which always came out of a can for me. And I was traveling as a 10-year-old in Spain with my parents, and I remember my mother ordering me a vegetable soup in a restaurant. And I was immediately depressed, because I thought it was going to be the vegetable soup that I hated. And out came a soup I had never had before. And I remember it to this day, some 50 years later, as being kind of greenish-gray and smooth.
Really?
And very delicious. And my mother, who is now 91, I was talking to her when I was writing the book, and I had mentioned this story to her. And she said, and I couldn't remember where I had had this soup, and she remembered without missing a beat and said, "Oh, that was in Zaragoza, and it was very late, and it was the so-and-so restaurant."
Oh,
and
funny.
I couldn't believe it. And all those memories came back, and I thought, soup, that's how soup touches people. It creates memories, and you kind of act upon memories.
We interviewed someone else who wrote a soup book. And what was that?
It's called I Love Soup, or something like that.
Soup Love.
Oh, soup, love soup.
But this, not to be confused with this one is, can I say, not saying it's not delicious, because it certainly is delicious, it's also erudite. Is that the word for it?
I guess you could say that, because I do spend some time thinking about history, historical root, and I like to, and given that it's about soups around the world, you have to introduce people to how someone in, let's say, Kazakhstan eats soups, because it becomes important in understanding how the soup is cooked. So, for instance, just to take that example, in Kazakhstan, a soup is almost like a meal. It isn't a first course as it is in Western countries. So
that's not Mongolia, is it? That's not Mongolia, is it?
Kazakhstan, a little further to the west of Mongolia, but
okay.
Central Asia, basically.
Yeah, we had our nephew married a Mongolian, and I'm looking forward to the first visit there, but not to their soup, but it consisted of a goat's head in a pot with some liquid.
Well, sounds fantastic to me.
Tell us, I'm just overwhelmed by the fact that there's so many interesting things in this book, aside from the recipes. It's just, how long did it take you to research this?
Well, actually, I cheated in a way, because a lot of the research for this book was actually conducted while writing another book. My book, A Mediterranean Feast, is a 1,000-page opus on Mediterranean food that won the James Beard Cookbook of the Year Award in 2000. And that book had about 10 times the amount of research. So in a sense, there was a lot of research already done, and I was just able to utilize research that I had begun some 20 years ago.
Can we still get a copy of that book? It sounds really interesting.
Yes, it's in print.
And
you can get it either via my website, cliffordawright.com, or you could go to amazon.com.
Uh-huh, great.
And many bookstores still carry it, too.
So it's really got legs, huh?
It does. I mean, we just celebrated its 10-year anniversary, so as you know, a book still in print 10 years later is an achievement.
I mean, here you have lobster mushroom and hazelnut butter soup. I mean, it just blows my mind how delicious that sounds.
It is an amazing soup, and it's it really is kind of a classic French soup, and what I mean by that is it's the kind of soup that you find, complex, almost like a restaurant soup. That doesn't mean that you can't make it at home. You can, but it requires a few more steps and so forth. The lobster mushrooms are so called because their skin color is very much like a lobster shell. And, of course, the hazelnut butter is a compound butter made by mixing hazelnuts and butter, usually in a food processor. And that makes for an amazing soup.
The organization of the book is interesting. Perhaps you can explain why you did it that way.
One reason is soups traditionally have been categorized according to the system used in classical French cooking, and which is fine for classical French cooking. But if you're talking about soups around the world, you have so many soups that fall outside of these categories, you don't know what to do with them. And if you're going to write a book of soups around the world, I needed to come up with new categories. So this, by the way, was the most agonizing part of the book, is trying to decide where to put these recipes.
Yeah.
So the approach that I took is you start with your basic broth, because all soups are based on broth. And then, of course, you move to things that you put into basic broth, which I call clear soups. So, for example, wonton soup would be an example of a clear soup. It's a broth with something in it. Then I move to chunky meat soups. That means that the soup has chunks in it. Chunky vegetable soups, chunky legume soups for the next three chapters. And then once you move away from chunky, you move to smooth. And that usually means you've used a blender. So smooth vegetable soups, smooth cream soups, smooth legume soups. And then I move to the more really substantial soups, minestrone, and soups that are like minestrone. Then the rest of the chapters in the book are soups based on grain, meaning they have either noodles or rice or barley in them. And then chowders and bisques, cheese soups and egg soups, seafood soups, and chilled soups.
Now what?
Consists of all of the soups that you could possibly have.
Now, what makes a bisque different than a cream soup?
I'm sorry, what makes a bisque different than a
cream soup?
It's interesting. Only one thing, really. It's seafood. So bisques have seafood in it, and cream soups, if they have seafood in it, they're called a bisque.
So it's a special category of a cream soup that just happens to
have seafood. It's a very special category, and in fact, it really is and rests upon a classical French notion.
I will say that, listeners, that you're going to encounter things you never knew existed, such as foo-foo. How about foo-foo?
I laugh because it really is a pretty obscure, an accompaniment, but foo-foo is an African, a West African, how should you call it, a paste. It's usually made out of some kind of starch, for instance, potatoes or plantains, or cassava, and the way you make it is you pound it with red palm oil, and it's very, very bland. And the reason you make it and the reason you eat it, especially in West Africa, is because the food is so spicy hot, you need to cut the heat of the chili with a bland food, and that's what fufu is for.
Okay.
And you eat it in this big, massy, sticky, doughy glop that you pinch off with your fingers, and you dip that into the very spicy soup.
That sounds like that Ethiopian bread.
It's not the same thing, but the principle of eating is the same thing, yes.
Now, some of these soups that you have are classics, iconic even. And I wondered if you've researched it enough, since you're into research and also testing the recipes, if I look at this white garlic soup with bread and cheese, can I assume that this is probably the best, since your title was the best, the very best version of this soup that I will ever find?
I would think so, because I put a lot of effort into the research behind this book. So, for instance, how do you handle a soup that's a classic? You're not the first person to have done it. So let's say the example you just used, or a velouté Joinville, which is a famous French soup with mussels and shrimp. Well, my approach is to look at as many recipes as I can. And, of course, many of these soup I've tasted in one way or another, either at a restaurant, at someone's house, or I've made them myself. And you keep doing that until you tweak it to the best possible recipe. And that's a lot of what I did with the classic soups. The more innovative soups, you don't have that problem. With the classic soups, you have to pay great attention to what kind of detail you're looking at to make them the best in the world.
Right, so you sort of heading for sort of a eureka moment. And then you leap out of the bathtub and run through the streets of Alexandria without your clothes on because you know you've got it just right.
That's just about it. And in fact, we sit in the kitchen, and usually it's my family or friends who are testing the recipes, and it'll be silent around the table, and someone, usually one of my children, will say, "This is a keeper."
Oh, really? How old are your children?
And that means there's nothing left to be done to this recipe. It's perfect.
Oh, that's how old are these children?
They're in their 20s.
Okay, so they really have an experienced palate.
They do. They've traveled a lot. They've lived abroad, and they've been eating my food for, you know, all of their 20 years.
Now, how would you think that people would use this book? I always ask this silly question. How do you think people will use this book how you had it in your mind when you wrote it?
I've always loved soups, but I never cooked them very frequently. And so the writing of this book put me in a position where I was making soups almost every day. And so we had a lot of soups around this house. And so we got a little bit skewed as to how you actually use a book like this and how you use and eat soup. But one thing that popped in my mind in the process of doing this is soups are just fabulous for lunches. And although I tend to eat soup also as first courses, I enjoyed them most as a lunch because I always had leftover soup from the previous evening's recipe. And, of course, we enjoyed it.
Yeah,
but the next day's lunch soup was fabulous.
Breakfast. I love soup, leftover soup for breakfast.
Yeah.
That's good. You have a recipe, Rick Bayless's, one of his recipes.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing that you bring in other chefs.
Well, sometimes I feel that other chefs, other cooks, have really perfected a recipe, and there's no improvement I'm going to make on them. So I like to give them credit and publish it here in a specialized book that's only on soups. And basically, it's a way of giving credit where credit is due.
So which is Rick Bayless's? Is that taco soup? Or
black bean.
Oh, black bean soup. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, because you absolutely adore black bean soup anyway.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and that is a magnificent one.
Yeah, we have a Pepe's recipe. I mean, brief cousin's husband. I mean, well, you know what I mean, which is a Cuban. Now, you have these little sections with amazing facts, like the soup is based on trust.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain that one?
Well, I think that what I meant when I wrote that is so often soups have ingredients that don't make sense, or they have methods that don't make sense. In other words, if you're going to cook a hamburger, you'll see bread, or let's say a cheeseburger. You'll see the beef patty, the cheese, the bread. You know what you're going to get. When you look at a soup recipe, you don't know what you're going to get. You have to trust the person who's writing this recipe. So if you see a recipe for black kale soup with potatoes and thyme and black kale and kidney beans and pumpernickel bread, you may scratch your head.
Yes.
And think, I don't know about this. And that's where the trust comes in.
Okay, because you tried it, and by adding this, that, and the other ingredient, you felt that it was at its best.
It's at its best, and you will like it. So in other words, you're almost saying to the reader, trust me, you'll like this.
And then you have this section on the ribollita, which I thought was cute.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us
people
about...
always ask for the recipe for ribollito, which is an Italian legume soup, basically. But even more importantly, it's not even strictly a legume soup. It's a leftover soup. There is no recipe. But I kept having people insist on a recipe, and I said, it's a leftover soup. There's no recipe. So I just kind of wrote something up and said, all right, you want a recipe? Then make the recipe on page 260, which incidentally is the black kale soup.
Mm-hmm.
And use white beans instead of red. Add a prosciutto or ham bone. Put a little bit more water, and don't use the pumpernickel. Then bake it, and you've got your ribollito.
And you bring in other things like this Latin American kid's dislike for soup. I thought that was cute, too.
It was very cute, and that's something that I actually discovered in more recent research and using the Internet. And I don't remember what it was I was looking for, but I stumbled upon that funny little story about how there was this comic book character in Latin American, I guess it was newspapers, and that children would read. And the character in the comic strip didn't like soup. And it affected how Latin American kids didn't like soup to be like the comic book character.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, listeners, across from that is the Ecuadorian peanut soup. But you also find tomato soup, turkey soup, onion soup. It's just absolutely a fabulous book. And my only problem is I don't know what to make first, Clifford, because they all sound so great.
Well, you might want to surprise yourself and make one of the most common soups in the world, a soup that everyone seems to buy out of a can, but if you make it homemade, it'll open your eyes, and that's a very simple cream of mushroom soup.
Oh, right. Yeah, somebody just tweeted that they actually bought a can of cream of mushroom soup and found it to be not all that bad.
I guess that happens.
Anyhow, this is a wonderful book. It's called The Best Soups in the World, and you're delightful. I'm glad that we met you, Clifford.
Great. Delightful to speak with you, too.
Yeah, and look forward to your other books.
And don't forget,
thanks very much.
And don't forget, listeners, you can keep in touch with everything Clifford Wright is up to by going to Clifford A., no punctuation marks, Wright.com. And we encourage you to do that, and we also encourage you, of course, to have this book on your bookshelf. And Clifford, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Clifford. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, listening to On the Menu, or we're talking On the Menu Radio. And we're going to be talking next with an interesting person in the form of a tea maker.
Well, we're not only a tea maker from Portland, Oregon, who makes absolutely the most wonderful teas, but a restaurant that wasn't included in our Portland coverage when we were there last fall for reasons that are a mystery to Peter, except that he just found the interview, and it was a very creditable interview with Chef Matt Christensen of the Urban Farmer, a modern steakhouse in Oregon, in a wonderful building called the Nines Hotel. But before that, Steve Smith just coincidentally happens to be in Portland, basing his operation, making the most marvelous teas, which Anne really enjoys, I think, better than any tea she's ever had before. So let's hear what Steve had to say about how he founded this company and what it stands for.
Well, I just asked our guest, Steve Smith, what he was drinking. Steve is a tea maker, and he told me. What are you drinking, Steve?
I'm drinking Mao Feng Shui.
Wow.
Sounds like a rude word.
Well, tea is actually called Mao Feng. It's a green tea from Zhejiang, China, and we think that it's best appreciated when your cup and saucer are in perfect alignment with your teapot.
Really?
That makes a big difference.
Yeah. It does, absolutely.
Well,
it's one of my favorites.
I've been drinking... See, I'm really a green tea person. That's that and white tea.
Mm-hmm.
I like pu'er, too. I like the white and green pu'er. Isn't that a possibility, right?
Well, I mean, I'm not a pu'er expert.
Oh, okay.
I've had plenty of the black, and I've not had green or white, quite frankly.
Well, anyhow, but I told you I've been drinking your hibiscus tea, and we were just starting to talk about that. But before we get into that, could we back up? I said to you, how do you become a tea maker? And you just let loose, and you have a huge, long history of tea.
Yeah, well, in 1971, I got involved in the natural foods business, and we had a little herb shop that was attached to our store. We ended up closing that retail business and focusing on distributing herbal teas. Actually, they're called herbal infusions. They're not teas at all.
The tisanes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and then gradually we moved into green and black teas as we started our company, Stash Tea Company, in 1972. And then from, you know, fast forward from 72 to 94, Stash Tea was sold in 93 to a Japanese tea company, and I started Tazo in my kitchen in January of 1994.
I want you to know, by the way, that Tazo has rescued me from nausea, the ginger tea, from when I had back surgeries.
Oh, boy.
I can't stand narcotic, you know, painkillers or anything like that. And so the only way I survived was drinking your ginger tea.
Well, I'm a big fan of ginger. Was it the green ginger tea, the green tea with ginger?
Probably.
Yeah, that's a nice blend. It takes a special ginger, a very juicy, sweet, hot ginger, mostly Chinese ginger, as opposed to Indonesian or South Indian, to make that tea sing.
Uh-huh.
So then from Tazo, so did Smith's Teas come next? Or?
Well, yeah. You know, started Tazo in 94, and it was acquired in 1999 by Starbucks, and I stayed with the company for another 7 years, and
wow.
Then, yeah.
Hold on a second. We got a decade out of phase there. You started Tazo in 2004 or 1994?
In 94.
94, okay.
Yeah, and then it was acquired in 99, as I mentioned, and then I stayed on for seven years and then left a couple years ago to spend some time with my family in France, and after living in France for a year and talking with cheesemakers and chocolatiers and people who grow and sell and package their own food and sell them personally in small batches, I was intrigued and decided to start this small batch, high quality tea company here in Portland.
And it's called Stephen Smith Teas?
It's called Stephen Smith Tea Maker.
Okay, that's the company name.
Okay, and which Portland are you in? You're in Portland,
Oregon.
Maine, or in Portland, Oregon?
I'm in Oregon.
Oh, we missed you. How come we missed him when
we
were there?
We were just there for that.
We were just out there.
Wild About Game event.
In September. Wasn't it September?
Oh, you were? Really?
Yeah,
we met some very interesting people, including several interesting people who are making
spirits.
Ah, house spirits people, probably.
Yeah,
house spirits is one of them. But we found some wonderful restaurants, and I guess people are into coffee. I didn't realize they were into tea. I guess you got them into tea.
Well, this is a big tea town too. Stash Tea started the whole tea explosion here, and there are a number of tea companies here, and yeah, I think I had something to do with that.
That's great.
Now, what makes your venture particularly special? I mean,
I'd like to think that it's my ability to create flavors that appeal to people. I've been doing this for a long time, and so what I do is I buy teas that I like, and I hope that other people like them as well. We don't spare any expense when it comes to the quality of the tea leaf. I have relationships with people all over the world who sell me tea. They send me samples, and they're willing to sell me tiny little quantities of tea because in the past they've sold me vast quantities of tea Tazo became a very large company. But what makes it different is that we get these great teas and we buy them at their peak period of quality. They come into Portland. We blend these teas in tiny little batches. We blend, our batches are between 21 and 30 pound batches, which is very, very small compared to what the larger blenders do. What we do is we blend that tea. We package that tea in a biodegradable sachet that has a silken look and appearance, and then we package that tea the very same day. So when the customer who buys our product, when they get our product, they're getting a product that is exceptionally fresh. It's almost a made-to-order tea. We carry very little inventory of packaged products here, and on the bottom of each cart that we pack is a batch number. When the customer goes to our website and enters the batch number on our website, it shows that customer exactly where each ingredient in that particular carton of tea, where each ingredient comes from, and when that individual ingredient was harvested. We can get to the week. Sometimes we get to the month. Occasionally we have to get to the season. But what we're doing is we're being completely transparent and allowing customers to get as close to origin as possible.
What was I going to ask? Oh, let's get that website in there then so people know exactly where to go.
Sure. It's smithtea.com.
Boy, how simple is that, huh?
Very simple.
Now, you've spent a lot of time on your packaging as well. You have this little box with the ties.
Yes.
That's unusual, but a lot of tea companies are big into packaging. Why is that? I appeal. Yeah, a lot of tea companies I see are very much into packaging.
Sure.
Is that
sure.
for I appeal? Is it because the competition's intense or what?
Well, the competition for shelf space is intense. I think that packaging is important, but packaging will only sell your product one time. If you look at our packaging, it is very simple. It doesn't have a bunch of color on it. It does not have images and of teapots or teacups or fruit that are supposed to be the flavor that is in the tea. We believe that we wanted to take a very, very simplistic approach, very clean approach to the package, and not have someone feel like they're buying pretty packaging. It's the product inside.
Now, how do people get some?
How do they get this tea?
Yeah, how do they get some? How do they know where they can buy it?
Well, on our website, there is a spot that says, at the bottom of the page, it says Finding Smith.
There we go.
If you click on that, it will tell you where the product can be found. We are just in a handful of accounts right now because we really started manufacturing and blending and packing, I should say, about a little less than 2 months ago.
Oh, wow. So this is really new.
It's very, very new. And we are in probably 50 or 60 locations now throughout the country. We're in places I should pull my site up while we're talking. We are in New York. We're at Zabar's in Portland, Oregon, where I'm from. We're in Better Retail Shop.
Can you shop on through the Internet, too?
You certainly can. Yes. We have products that are available on the Internet that are not available in retail stores. Rather than having hundreds of different products that we're putting into the market, what we're doing is we're being very focused and editing our product line so it's not confusing to customers. I think sometimes too much choice can...
Yeah, but you have... how many different types of teas do you have here?
Well, I have 12 types of tea that are packaged in cartons and in envelopes. And then I have another 25 or so varietal teas, different oolongs, jasmine pearl, some varietal herbs as well, like spearmint leaves and rooibos. But we try to focus on the products that we're putting into retail shops like Pemberton Farms in Cambridge or Bonnie's Kitchen in California in Santa Margarita or Durham Marketplace in Durham, New Hampshire. We keep that product line pretty focused.
Now, I just wanted to just read a description here to give people an idea how elegant this product is. This is not something you slop down, as a... Well, first of all, the caffeine is irrelevant, isn't it?
The caffeine?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is this is something to be savored, this all your blends, like white petal. That's delicate shade dried white tea from China with rare osmanthus flower and chamomile, fragrant and creamy with a sweet bloom of flavor. Now, that's something you sip and savor. You don't just slop it down.
Yeah, absolutely. That particular tea is a real special tea. We get beautiful Bai Mudan white tea from China, and then we have a series of screens that we hand condition these leaves. We do a light crush on the leaf, and then we mix the osmanthus flower in with the white tea, and we take chamomile blossoms that are golden that we get from Egypt, and we screen those blossoms to take some of the white petal that is on the blossom. We remove the white petal and we put the white petal in with the white tea. The white petal of the chamomile blossom has got a very honey-like, toasty characteristic, and it adds an amazing aroma and flavor nuances to this tea we call white petal.
Well, you're amazing, Steve. I mean, truly amazing, and so is this product. You're obviously very much in love with tea, and you're also very much experienced with tea. I hope that this product is very well received.
Well, thank you. We hope so, too. We are getting very good response, and this is a very intimate endeavor for me. I am passionate about tea, and I believe that I shouldn't be sitting behind a desk. I should be out in front talking with consumers about tea. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a demo in a specialty shop this afternoon, and then I'm doing another demo this weekend in a small pharmacy in rural Oregon to introduce this product to people. So I feel that passionate about it that I'm out there doing this stuff myself, that most tea companies would hire that out, but we believe that we can best represent our brand ourselves.
You should try getting it into the Allison, which is a gorgeous place. Did you know that, Allison?
Well, you know what? The Allison called me.
Okay, good.
They called me, and they've had the tea, and
that's wonderful.
And they love it, and they are working through the tea inventory that they currently have, and we should be in the Allison, I would expect, by the first of the year. So.
Well, that's wonderful. Steve, you're obviously a man who's totally dedicated to tea, and listeners, if you're dedicated to tea too, you obviously need to catch up with Steve Smith and Smith Teas.
Yeah, Steve, thank you for talking to us, and thank you for letting us experience your passion with tea.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate
it. Okay, Steve.
Thank you. Bye.
Matt Christensen, executive chef of Urban Farmer, was a competitor today in Wild About Game, cooking quail, right? What was your dish?
That's correct, Ann. Thank you for having me on the radio. My dish was a roasted crown of quail with a roulade of cabbage and the ground leg meat and some foie gras served over cornbread in a Staub cast iron skillet.
I sneaked some of that. I mean, usually you're not allowed to have that. But I was sitting next to a VIP, and I got to taste it. It was excellent.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
And I guess you'll know in about 10, 15 minutes who the winners are in that competition.
The sweat's rolling down my forehead right
I'll
now.
I'll bet. Let's talk a little bit about your restaurant, which is it's in a hotel?
Yes, it's on the 8th floor in the lobby of the Nines Hotel, which is in Portland, Oregon.
And why is it called the Nines?
We're going to cancel that because I can't answer that question. So you can cut that one out.
Okay.
There's a reason.
Because you're living knife to the Nines.
Yeah, there's a reason we just don't know. We'll just let it be a mystery.
What's its address? It has nothing to do with Nines. All right, we're going to get that. Okay. Now, tell me about the restaurant. What Urban Farmer. And what kind of cuisine is that?
Urban Farmer is a modern steakhouse, which means that it prepares dishes that are local and indigenous to the Portland area. We feature local grass-fed and grain-finished beef in many fashions.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yep, absolutely. But we also pull from the oceans, which are very near to us, and then local farmers. So it's an urban setting, but it feels very farm-to-table, like you're at my farmhouse eating on my table, and I went out into my garden and my ranches and produced the best of the bounty of what Portland area has to offer.
And you're not from here. You're from Wisconsin?
That's correct. So I'm a transplant of many different places, but finally find my way to the West Coast where I would love to stay.
Aha. Uh-huh. And what do you love most about Portland?
I love that it has the coastal feel, but it has mountains so near and dear to it as well. So four seasons, which means four definite growing seasons as well, which features all the wonderful bounties of each of those seasons that they have to offer.
And your children were born here?
My children were born in California and Colorado.
Okay, do you like that? Is it a good place for kids?
Oh, absolutely. They love their school and they love all their friends they've made here.
On your menu, what are some of your favorite things?
Some of my favorite things are simple things like mac and cheese.
Regular mac and cheese? No, it'll be
great. No, well,
it'll
we have little
gussied up.
Uh-huh. Gussied up mac and cheese with Gruyere and brioche breadcrumbs and lots of tomato confit that we produce out of the summer tomatoes, and then we can them and save them throughout the winter.
Sounds really good.
Then our aged steaks are just unmatched. We have our own aging room to let the steaks naturally age, lose their moisture, and then they have a higher fat content and become super tender.
So you
and very
age
delicious.
The bones, the restaurants. And the
yeah, restaurants. We age on the bone. We do all of our butchering from primals.
Do you have some really good grass-fed people?
Absolutely. We have a ranch called Highland Oak Farm, and they hang their cattle for 28 days before we even get it, which means that it allows the meat to rest and becomes very, very tender.
And is that the only grass farmer you use?
Currently, yes.
Have you tried tall grass out of Kansas?
We've tasted them quite a while ago, and we'll give them another shot.
Oh, is yours better? I want to know.
It is better.
Well, you have to give me that name off air.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell people about your restaurant, about why to come there? And I also would like a website.
Okay. Urban Farmer is at urbanfarmerrestaurant.com. Our menus can be viewed there. They're ever-changing. They change with the seasons. Urban Farmer is a very indigenous experience to Portland, just like the Nines. The Nines is a very art-driven fashion hotel, very high styling, and Urban Farmer is a very homely feel. So it's a very good balance of the both when you come into the building and dine with us.
I think we ought to look into staying at that place next time we're in Portland.
Well, we... As you know, listeners, we frequently come to cities and we leave with more places to go than we had when
we
started.
Have.
Right.
And the same is going to happen with Portland, Oregon. So maybe the Nines and Urban Farmer will be on our list the next time. If not, they certainly should be in your plans when you come to Portland and say hi to Matt.
And Matt, go find out who won.
And now, right. And now we're going to go send Matt off to get his prize.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thank you very much, Ann.
Thank you, Matt. Well, we have such a good time in Portland, Oregon. I just think it's a great community, a great chef's community, a source community. It's just terrific. If it didn't rain all the time, I'd like to live there.
And we're undoubtedly on the menu, we'll go back, and we would commend you to do the same thing. And you can look up Steve, and you can look up Matt, and some other friends from previous programs when you're there.
Right. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are. And have you ever wondered why you can't just dream up a product? I mean, why is it that all these people come up with an idea and all of a sudden there's a big company and it's a brilliant idea? Don't we all get ideas?
I think we do, but these particular people, only one of them who was talking to us, but she and her friend founded this company, and to say they were dedicated and mm-hmm. single-minded
yeah.
would be an absolute understatement. But this is a product for the springtime, or if you want to fine spray of olive oil or balsamic vinegar
when you're in the kitchen year round.
There are all kinds of great reasons why this is a superior product called Gourmet Mist, and you'll want to listen up, and I'm sure you'll want to get one.
I guess
or
the,
two.
The key is you have to have the idea, but you also have to have the follow through.
Oh, they certainly had a lot of follow through, as you'll find out when you listen to the interview.
Since I've been a mister for years, ha ha ha, very clever, huh? And Mrs. Hay can't say that because she's a missus. But I've been a mister using a product called a Misto for probably now about 8 years, and about every year and a half they break. We were rather excited to find Gourmet Mist, and we wanted to try it, and we also wanted to talk to the owner and co-founder of this business about how she started. Did she ever have a misto?
Okay, now let's introduce it properly.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. I thought she was just going to get my cue. Go ahead, Simona.
Simona, tell us about how this product came to be.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on your great show today.
Yeah, let's, by the way, spell out this, because I'm the first email I sent to you, I had it spelt wrong. It's not E-T, it's G-O-U-R-M-E with the, is it accent?
It's a schwa.
A schwa. Is that a schwa?
That's what they call them, I guess.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's a French little accent mark.
Yeah, I was going to call it an accent aigu, or as opposed to grave.
I think what it's there for is to stop Gourmet Magazine from putting them out of business using that name. But let's get back on track.
It's all about, we're all about brand image here. So we want it to be different. We want it to stand out with our unique product. So we really, when we're figuring out the name for our product and we came up with Gourmet Mist, we wanted to be a little bit different. So therefore we dropped the T and added the accent mark on the E. So then this way, you know, not only does the brand look a little bit different, but it also gives it that gourmet feeling.
Great. Now tell us about how you invented it
for a particular reason, though. So go ahead and explain that.
Okay. Well, basically about 5 years ago, I was given Misto, like you just discussed. It's a refillable container that you can purchase, you know, in houseware stores. And I was filling it with oils, vinegars, whatever out there. And I would love the way it worked, but you have to refill them. And you actually really have to clean them, which I did not know. And it would start clogging, and it would start spitting. So, therefore, it didn't provide that even mist. And I just kept saying to my business partner, she was in my kitchen one day. We were just talking, making eggs, making an omelet. I was using the Misto, and I kept telling her, I love this product, but I really don't like the way that it's spitting because it's now getting really clogged because apparently it's really old. And she says to me, well, you know what? Maybe you just need to go and buy a disposable one. And I said, yeah, you're right. And we started, you know, it came up as a joke. I actually really was into the concept of the misting so much that I did start looking for a disposable product. So I went to all the grocery stores in my, you know, where I lived. I went to houseware stores. I went online. I mean, I got so into it that it took me like 2 months of basically searching for a disposable one. And then we decided we couldn't find it. So Shireen just says to me one day, you know what, why don't we make it? Since it obviously doesn't exist. From that point on, we started doing a lot of research, started trying to find the perfect bottle, home configuration, and so forth. And it was a very difficult time to actually get it figured out and get it, you know, just to have even a few samples made. And Shireen and I ended up making about 300 samples in our kitchen. Literally, just one day, we found all the parts, did all our research. We made the samples, gave them out to family and friends. People started using them, and they said, you guys, this is great. You guys have to take this to market.
Now, the critical ingredient is the pump part, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's about basically the dispenser, but, of course, we use it in conjunction with high-end oils and vinegars as well.
Now, let's go back over this clogging and cleaning thing again, because I experienced it, and I've worked around it, because instead of now getting mist, I get sort of more like a steady stream, and what I've done is I've worked my cooking technique so that that's just perfectly fine, but I never even thought about cleaning it. And you're absolutely right. I mean, not only is the little nozzle getting blocked up, but the whole of the inside of the unit is also carrying the residue of what was in there before.
Which is rancid.
So if you want to put in a different kind of thing, then you're going to get it tainted from what was in there before. So you've combined this idea of disposable, which presumably you managed to go however many pumpings it is, 500 pumping or 384 pumpings or whatever it is, and it doesn't wear out. But you've combined that with some extraordinary ingredients as well. So tell us about those.
Could I jump on something before
sure
she does this?
Sure,
I think that the disposable idea is something we should address, because Simona said this is a recyclable. It's not a disposable in that sense.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, very good. Well, you're correcting me as usual.
I was just making a point.
I need to be corrected for saying it wrong, but that's okay.
Oh, you guys are so funny.
She's on at me all the time. I can never get anything right. I recycled the misters when they broke too. I found that I tended to knock them off the table by the grill and they would land on the floor and inevitably the little sleeve inside the lid would break.
Well, you know, Shireen and I are very green in our lifestyle. We've been for a very, very long time. We're all about recycling, using earth-friendly products and so forth. And when we came up with this idea, we really did want to make sure that it's not just something that's going to be thrown out and put in the landfill, because obviously it's a plastic PET container that we use. Therefore, we engineered it to where it is 100% recyclable. And what I mean by that is even the entire pump, the screw, the pop-on collar, the cap, every part of the bottle can just, it does not need to be, you know, taken apart. It can just be thrown in the recycling bin. And we stress that all over our container, that it is recyclable, and we put cycling signs everywhere. We also put that in all of our media and marketing messages as well, because it's so important to let people know that please recycle this container, just because we don't want it to go in the landfill. And we did work so hard to make it recyclable. So therefore, it is 100% first green product of its kind, because it is non-aerosol, so it doesn't use those high, you know, propellants that the aerosol cooking sprays use. You can't recycle an aluminum can anyway, and with our container, you can recycle the entire plastic. Plus, we even use a better plastic. And just to expand on that a little bit, we even use certain high-quality plastic to where it does not contain plasticizers. Therefore, there is no plastic that seeps into the salt, so the vinegar and the oil stays fresh the entire time.
Well, you are really very thoughtful about this. I have to admit, with sin, and Anne will say the same thing. We did once upon a time used to spray things with Pam, but we got over that.
I never sprayed.
You didn't tell. Well, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you sprayed cookie sheets with
Pam. No, I didn't.
You know what?
I never have either.
Even since it first came out, I never did. It's all artificial ingredients in there. Nothing to say. They have a great product and they have a great marketing message. And you know, everybody knows what Pam is. However, it is artificial ingredient. Today's day and age, we're all very concerned about our health, and we need to try to use as much all-natural products as we possibly
can. Yeah, well, they were actually trying to market it as, instead of a non-stick thing, but actually an ingredient. They had flavors of it, and then I helped them arrange it.
I remember Tony, fancy, you know, Tony cooked with it, and everything tasted like Pam. It was just awful.
And not only that, but the place smelled.
Yeah, and it had a lot of their products actually have silicone in them as well.
Well, now, not only that, but they dropped that campaign in the back, the non-stick now.
Let's not slam Pam.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be supportive of Gourmet Miss, because you've sourced some very special ingredients as well. And right now you have six, but I'm sure you're probably going to have some more.
We're coming out with a different one this year. So let me tell you first of all what we have now.
Okay.
We actually have six products. We've got three oils and three balsamic vinegars. Our oils consist of all natural extra virgin olive oil, first cold pressed, very high quality. We also have an organic extra virgin olive oil that's first cold pressed, and we have an organic canola oil that's actually top of the line canola oil that we source from Switzerland. And our balsamic vinegars are all from Modena, obviously. Our barrel aged balsamic vinegars are number two seller, and basically it's the best vinegar. I will not say this because I strongly believe it and because people tell us this all the time. It really is one of the top quality balsamics that you'll ever find. It's barrel-aged up to about 18 years, comes straight from Modena. We also have a barrel-aged pomegranate balsamic and a barrel-aged raspberry balsamic. That are, you know,
we didn't get all those, on
our are you buying a balsamic from the consortium?
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, how much does this cost then? I mean, I spent $125 in Modena for a little teeny tiny bottle of, 25 years or whatever?
Yeah,
no, I think it was. I think that was 40-year-old.
I was going to say, for that price, it has to have been over 25 years. Actually, our product retailed between $6.49 and $7.99 in grocery stores. But I do have to tell you, we spent a lot, you know, we really have high-end ingredients, and I understand, you know, that it's hard to get that retail price with, you know, high-end ingredients. So obviously we're not using a 40-age, you know, balsamic vinegar.
No, of course you're not.
Our balsamic vinegar, actually the same quality retails under different brands for $40. Huh. And that we retail between $6.49 to $7.99.
See, I never understood. I never would have thought that we needed to mist with the vinegar, just the oil.
Yeah, that was part of the invention.
Yeah, we never thought about it. I mean, I guess if you're dressing a salad, it's one way to make sure you don't get too much.
Absolutely. And if you notice, whenever you pour vinegar, whatever it is, whether it's regular vinegar, red wine, balsamic, white balsamic, you're always pouring a little bit too much, and you kind of don't want vinegar. You have to be very careful to just get the right amount. And also, when you're pouring, you're getting it only in one spot. So with our misters, it's, you know, the way they work, we specifically engineered these pumps to be able to provide that wide spray with really getting an even coverage on all of your lettuce. Whether it doesn't even necessarily just have to be for salads. I mean, I use the balsamic vinegar to marinate steaks, meats. I spray it, fish down with it. I mean, there's so many uses for gourmet mist.
Sandy, you've always cooked, apparently, huh?
You know what? I have not, to tell you. I am not a cook, but my mother is. And the reason that I came up with this is because I'm obsessed with healthy eating. I am very into nutrition. However, I'm not a cook. So, therefore, what I did was I'm all about fast. You know, I'm a businesswoman, so I'm all about fast on the road, traveling all the time. I need quick and easy solutions. I make a lot of breakfast as my favorite meal of the day, and I actually make omelets every single morning, an egg white omelet. So I always have to spray my skillet with something, and I was using the misto before, obviously, it started clogging. So I actually, when we invented the concept, we did it specifically just for making this omelet, and I knew I needed to coat a pan. But once we created gourmet mist and we realized that we were actually going to put vinegars as well in the misters, we really started using salads, making salads, using it for the eggs. I make very quick things. For example, our signature dish that you can find, like, on our website, and it's our signature gourmet mist. We call it the Gourmet Mist Girls signature dish that we literally, Shireen and I, make every single day. We just cut up tomato, we cut up avocado, we mist it with the olive oil, mist it with the balsamic vinegar, throw some Asiago cheese and some ground pepper. It takes 5 minutes to make. It's delicious. It fills you up. It's great to use as an appetizer, as a side salad. It's just so simple and delicious. And once our vinegar and olive oil goes on the tomato and the avocado, it's just great. It's a delicious, delicious salad. Everybody that we give it to and let them taste it, people just love it. And it's so easy to make. So you can make a lot of quick things with gourmet mist, as well as you can use it. The chefs love it. I mean, we've got chefs all across the country that absolutely just love gourmet mist.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. And also with the, give them a squeeze bottle and a gourmet mist, and they're ready to go.
Yeah, exactly.
people can lay their hands on the gourmet mist product line. You were telling us before we went on the air, you can get it across the country. Do you have a store finder, or is it just go ahead.
On our website, there's store finders, but basically any major chains in any state carry the product. So if you're specifically, if you're in some location in the country and you really want to know where specifically we have the stores, you can go on our website, and we do list by state all the stores that we're available in.
Now, how did you expand? Is it only a year old? How did you get this far in 1 year?
Isn't that crazy? People tell us this all the time at trade shows. We actually launched, I'll give you guys like a brief little summary. We launched the product with our samples. We didn't even have the first production run that we made in a real factory of product that we could actually sell. These are samples we just made in the kitchen. We launched it last year, 2008, Fancy Food Show in New York City.
Yeah, we missed it because we got all those. I missed that.
Yeah. Became an instant success. I mean, we really were like the hit of the show. And people loved the product. I mean, everybody from, you know, buyers all across the grocery stores to cooks, to chefs, to just foodies. People just loved it. They loved the concept. They also loved our contemporary packaging. When Shireen and I came up with this idea, it was all about the packaging. We literally are revolutionizing the way we use oils and vinegars in our kitchen. So we wanted something really unique, very contemporary, very sleek, very sexy.
Now, you were a marketer before?
No, we were not. Shireen and I were in a financial industry. We had a financial business, a service business.
Wow.
And we completely had nothing to do with food or the grocery business. Of course, you know, we had a lot of marketing experience for the service business that we had, but we absolutely had no idea at all anything about food or anything about grocery products or anything about the industry. I mean, we literally just jumped in with our eyes closed.
Well, listen, the listeners, it's www.gourmetwithouta.com. What else can we say before we sign off except you got to get one. In fact, you got to get you got to get one of each and have them in your kitchen. That's exactly what we have. And Simona, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
And I wish you the best of luck with your product, Simona.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, as they used to say at the end of the cartoon programs, that's all, folks, for another week. We'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.